everyone. We're very pleased to see you. This is a what will become an annual event for the British Journal of Sociology. We're going to have an annual panel event or a lecture. Traditionally, sociology has been regarded as a discipline which helps us to understand the world and ideally contributes to its improvement. Whether or not this is realistic or even desirable, though, has become the subject of some controversy within the discipline, with some people believing that it's an impossible and even futile ambition. There is a view that sociology has forgotten about social issues, lost its critical edge, and in doing so, lost its public voice. And this is in an era when government claims that its policies are evidence-based, when the ESRC, which is the UK's main funder of social science research, wants to know when you apply to them for funds about the potential user value and the contribution to the UK economy of your research and its influence over policy making. This is a debate that's not just confined to the UK. Public sociology was the theme of the American Sociological Association's annual meeting this summer, and its president stated, more than ever, the world needs public sociologies. Sociologies that transcend the academy and engage wider audiences. Whether they successfully do that's open to debate. And a BJS debate earlier this year on the relationship between sociology and government didn't offer a very positive answer to that sort of question. And one commentator wrote, the reputation of sociology for practical utility is at a historical low. This evening we're going to follow through the debate about the relationship of sociology with one of its key audiences, government. We're going to start with the very important issues that were raised in the BJS debate, which is incidentally accessible for free online through Blackwell Synergy. And then we're going to broaden the debate out. And we're going to do that with the aid of a very distinguished and experienced panel. I want to turn first to Hugh Lauder, who's Professor of Education and Political Economy at the University of Bath. His BJS paper with Philip Brown and Chelly Halsey is one of a number of publications that they have written together, and it was their paper that actually initiated the whole debate. Now I'm wondering, Hugh, if you could explain to us why you came to write the paper and what you would all regard as its main messages.
Thanks, Bridget. I just should say, first of all, that Chelly Halsey, one of my co-authors, is sitting in the front row. Whatever I say will be entirely my responsibility, and he no doubt will correct me if I'm off message. The other author is sunning it in Cuba at the International Comparative Ed Conference, gives his apologies. I think that there are two motivations that we had for writing this paper. The first motivation was to do with the perception that evidence-based social science was, as it were, in favor, that there were opportunities for social sciences in the way that perhaps there had not been in the mid-1980s under Thatcherism, when perhaps a certain strand of neoclassical economics was to the fore, but not much else. So that was one motivation. And then, as it were, the other side of that motivation was quite simply the concern that we had that the discipline of sociology was not being well regarded in government circles, nor indeed that very often some very important research wasn't getting out to the public in the manner of a more public debate. Perhaps the world is now more complex in terms of getting airtime, where there was once research are now think tanks. There are a whole range of intermediaries between oneself as a researcher and as a theorist and the public that you might wish to reach. In part, though, I think that it's also a question that we don't focus enough on getting and writing clearly and with a wider audience than just perhaps our colleagues in mind. So those were the particular issues that prompted us to have a go at writing a paper which wasn't seen by us in any way at all as definitive. Quite the contrary, what we were simply doing was suggesting that here were a few issues that might spark a debate. I'm not quite sure we anticipated it would spark a debate which would end, let's not say end at LSE, but would have part of its route through LSE tonight. But that was the motivation.
Okay, thank you, that's helpful. We also had in the debate a number of policymakers responding, which is probably a bit of a departure for the journal, and it's been a very interesting departure. We have with us this evening Phil Davis, who's spent some 30 years as an academic sociologist, most recently in the Department of Continuing Education at Oxford. He joined the Cabinet Office in the year 2000, and he loved it so much that he stayed. And he's now Deputy Director of the Government Chief Social Researcher's Office. We also have Paul Johnson, who's currently Chief Microeconomist in the Treasury. Interestingly, Google doesn't like the word microeconomist. It changes it to macroeconomist, which is one of the interesting things you find out. He was formerly Chief Economist and Director of Analytical Services at the Department of Education and Skills. Before that, worked at the Financial Services Authority and the Institute for Fiscal Studies. He's also, of relevance to this audience, a council member of the Economic and Social Research Council. Now, both of these people contributed to the BJS debate, and they seem to agree that there was a need for a greater sociological input to policy making, but they doubted that there were the capabilities to realise this. And I think you both, along with Paul Wilds, who unfortunately can't be here this evening, identified a number of reasons that sociology didn't appear to figure very much. One was a skills deficit, and in particular, reference to a lack of quantitative skills. And secondly, a communication deficit, although I'm unclear, maybe they will clarify for us whether or not that seemed to be confined to sociology. Phil, could I ask you to address those points first?
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to this debate, and I, like you, hope it doesn't end at the LSE, but continues for some time. The skills deficit, and incidentally, Paul and I honestly did not concur on this at all, and quite independently, and Paul Wiles came to similar observations, is that a lot of the work that we need to be done in government requires a combination of qualitative and quantitative skills. It needs an understanding of the experimental methods, and I say that plural, experimental and quasi-experimental methods, as well as naturalistic studies, doing ethnographies and studies in more naturalistic settings. And it's that combination that is, I think, noticeably lacking. And particularly, I think, when we look at the experimental area, things like not just randomized controlled trials, but methods such as regression discontinuity designs, constructed time series designs, propensity score matching designs. These are the sorts of techniques that we need to analyze policy for policymakers and for ministers. And we largely can't find them in much of British sociology. We recruit, as I said in the article, some of the finest social researchers, sociologists in the Social Research Service, with good qualifications. And getting that combination of skills is very difficult, if not impossible, which means, incidentally, we're often having to take our work to particularly the United States and Canada, sometimes Australia, to other countries where there is a greater tradition of not just doing quantitative and experimental work, but of integrating it with those other fine traditions of qualitative work, ethnography, and naturalistic inquiry. So they were the particular skills. Second is a skill, and I think the communication issue is another skill. It is clear that as sociologists, we do have a particular insight. We have a particular way of understanding and interpreting the world. And it's perfectly fair, fine and dandy that we have, to a certain extent, our own language and our own way of communicating. But there is an equal need to communicate with an outside world. And the outside world isn't just the policy wonks that we work with in Whitehall and our ministers, but the general public, who I think often find sociology a little opaque, a little hard to understand. And I think that is a skill, and it's a skill that our social researchers, we have about 850 social researchers in government, a lot of their work is doing some sort of translation work to take the often fine findings of sociological papers and making them, finding out what the essential message is, finding out what the caveats and qualifications are, and making those accessible to people who, frankly, could use them very much. If we don't get those skills right, I can tell you what's going to happen, it happens now, is that sociology will be marginalized. You'll get the think tanks, the private research corporations, the opinionated social researchers coming to the fore, because one thing they're very good at is that capturing the essence of a problem, often in very simplistic terms, and getting an audience to listen to it.
Thank you. I start off just by agreeing with everything that Bill has just said. But let me start by saying something positive, because it's very easy to be very negative throughout a kind of discussion like this. It is clear that the government is genuinely interested in evidence. The number of social researchers, the number of economists in government have increased by between 50 and 100% since 1997. The amount of money that government spends on social science has risen by tens of millions of pounds a year over that period. So the quantity of investment directly and through research councils and so on has gone up in a very serious way. And given the sort of ideological bent of the government, there is a genuine requirement and a genuine desire to see what works, to understand how the world works, and to feed social science research in. Now, let's not be daft about this. Politics matter, and just because you've got good evidence doesn't mean that you will get the policy that the evidence points to, but it means you're much more likely to get the policy that the evidence points to. And it seems to me, my duty within government to at least ensure that ministers take decisions in cognizance of what the evidence is, even if they then decide to go in a different direction. So this is, it seems to me, a very good time, exactly as you said, a very good time to be talking about this, because it's a very fertile time for government to use social science. And I'm going to talk more about social science in general than sociology in particular, as an economist rather than a sociologist myself. Seems to me there are two kinds of, there's a range of kinds of influence that social science can have on policy. From the very general messages that come from the social sciences, very simple ones from economics about competition and free trade being a good thing, very broad messages from sociology as well, right through sort of more specific issues about the impact, for example, of active welfare to work policies, which has had a very big impact on the way that the DWP, the Department for Work and Pensions, works, through to very specific questions about which particular policy works best. What does policy X have a positive benefit-cost ratio or not? There's a whole range of ways in which social science can impact. I think one of the things that social scientists need to do is to think about at what point along that spectrum are they trying to make an impact. Secondly, it's also important, I think, to understand the different places in government that you can have an impact. Just as there is good social science and bad social science, there are good places to use social science in government and places that are less receptive to it. And the role of the centre of government is different from the role of the spending departments and so on. Actually understanding that is rather important. Let me say something then about communication and skills. I moved from a career doing economic research, very much I thought at the kind of public policy end of economic research, and moved into government. And it really struck me kind of how very, very different those worlds are, much more different than I'd appreciated. I think this is one of the key things that's important for people on both sides of the divide, as it were, to understand that the assumptions and the things that drive academics and policymakers are quite different. Let me just give you some examples. I think understanding those examples really can help to understand how to communicate. The first is just about the method of communication. Academics quite naturally communicate in a particular way through journal papers and seminars, concentrate on methodologies and assumptions and data, as well as coming up with the results. Very long-term process. Policymakers are much more focused on much shorter, much clearer, much more simplistic, you might think, in some cases, methods of communication. You do not communicate to policymakers as you would communicate to each other, I think is the first, is a really important issue. Second one is about timing. Timeliness in government is everything. Part of this is just a kind of misunderstanding, I think, among some in government about what social science can achieve in particular timescales, but actually being clear about how quickly you can do things and presenting the information at the time when it will have the most impact is very important. And again, to achieve that, that requires a dialogue, a continuing dialogue between the policymakers, the translators, as I think Phil quite rightly put it, within government, those who act as the interface between between academia and policy. There's a set of assumptions as well, which are not necessarily shared between the two audiences. I'm going to quote two things from a great article I've got here by Diane Coyle, which I think is entitled How to Think Like an Economist and Why It Matters. And it ends up with this wonderful quote, which I think is dead right, which it says, where common sense and economics conflict, common sense is wrong. You might think that about common sense and sociology. But the point is that it's all very well for economists to say that, or sociologists to say that, but you do need to understand where it does conflict with common sense or received wisdom. And if you go kind of charging in without realizing that, then you can get into trouble. So how do you communicate? It seems to me kind of part of this discussion to be about that. First of all, is there are ways in to government, there are ways into departments, whether it be via the chief social researcher or the chief economist, whether it be via the Treasury, and there are people in the Treasury who cover just about everything, whether it be through the senior civil servant policymaker who's engaged. There are ways in. I spent 4 years as chief economist at the DFES, did a great deal to work with academics outside, but I can't think of more than one or two occasions where one came proactively to me and said, hey, but I've got some interesting research here. I had to do, as it were, all the work to get that in, and that was a shame. And there's a real market there, and it's a marketplace for ideas, exactly as Phil says. If you don't, as a serious researcher, say something, then a much less serious researcher will say it. One of the real issues here is actually about the relationship between good social science and bad social science. There's an awful lot of bad social science as well as good social science out there, and if the good social science isn't communicating, then the bad social science gets in its way in a really big way. One or two encounters with bad stuff can really put people off. And just to show that I don't believe all economics is good, another quote from this article about why it's important to be an economist states, I think that the scale of meaningless formalism, bad writing, and lack of thought about the nature of the world in academic economics does constitute a deep institutional problem in our our subject. I think that's probably true of more than just economics and the social sciences, and it's a problem sorting out the wheat from the chaff. Quickly on skills. I agree very much about the importance of quantitative skills. Two other things really matter. Understanding the policy area in which you're working matters. And actually understanding the difference in your knowledge from the knowledge of the policymaker. The great thing about academia is that knowledge is deeply embodied in the people who are working there in a way that it just isn't in public policy. So very often the more important thing is to explain, this is everything we know and this is the little bit of extra stuff that I found out, rather than make a great deal of the bit that you found out. The importance of quantitative skills is particularly important on the specific policy areas. The thing that very often politicians want to know is, if I've got this policy and I'm evaluating it, what is the scale, what is the quantity of the impact relative to the costs of that? Now, on the whole, that kind of work goes to economists because there are not enough sociologists equipped with the skills and tools to do that. And I think that's actually a genuine shame, because economists will bring a particular view to this, and it will be useful, important to get the sociological view as well. But there's a lot of, again, bad empirics around as well. So to sum up, what matters? First of all, language. Language really matters. Academics, sociologists, economists speak a different language to policymakers, and it's important that both sides understand that. Secondly, assumptions. Be clear about your assumptions. Explain them. Don't assume that everyone else shares your assumption. The right networks and communications are desperately important in this. It's not that hard to get the networks, the communications with those in the social research profession, in the economics profession, policymakers, treasury, if you've got good things and important things to say. And you can do this through the media as well. An article in the Financial Times has a huge impact. And finally, don't underestimate the damage that bad social science does. Be free to admit, be open about the fact that some stuff is not, is not good social science, just as I'm quite happy to be open about the fact that not all policy is evidence-driven and not all policy is good policy.
Thank you, Paul. I think he's just invited you all to contact him tomorrow morning with your research ideas. If we move beyond policymaking, sociological contributions to government go beyond policymaking and they can extend to influencing government strategy and philosophy. And this is the influence of two members of this panel who are both said to be extremely good communicators of sociological work. Tony Giddens is the former director of the LFD, currently attached to the Centre for the Study of Global Governance at the LFD, and also a fellow of King's College Cambridge and a member of the House of Lords. His work on the Third Way and the Third Way and its critics attracted the interest of leading politicians, and he is said to have been a very strong influence on New Labour in Britain. Amitai Etzioni, Professor of Sociology, a former president of the American Sociological Association, a senior advisor to the White House, and best known probably as the founder and director of the Cube Communitarian Network and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He's currently here promoting his new book, From Empire to Community, which advocates a communitarian approach to international affairs and foreign policy. They're both eminent sociologists, and in their own ways, they are activists who have successfully influenced government. I'd like to ask you both how you would assess your own contribution to national and indeed international thinking, and if you do in fact perceive yourselves to have been successful in influencing government. Tony, do you want to say?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, talking about jokes, you can tell how important you are by how many jokes exist about you, and there are a lot more jokes about economists than there are about sociologists. Two sociologists walking along a road, right, and they see a man in a ditch, kind of beaten up and injured, and the first sociologist says to the second sociologist, "We've got to find the person who did this, he needs help." I mean, a lot of jokes that exist about sociology, about the partisan nature, if you like, of sociological thinking. Well, I mean, the impact of sociology on government, there are two things you can do. You can try to influence the climate of ideas around government, and you can try to influence particular policies. And I feel I was just extremely lucky in being able to contribute a bit to the first as well as to the second. I mean, Amitai, I think, has had a bit of the same experience of me, but I was lucky. It was unusual. I got invited to the first Blair-Clinton dialogues, which were held in Chequers, and there were, I think, five or six members of the British cabinet and five or six members of the American cabinet. Hillary Clinton was the inspirer of this event. And the only other academic there was Joe Nye from the Kennedy School at Harvard University. And I was just very privileged to be in this group, and it's amazing how you can, in a way, influence politicians. You know, sort of opposite of what has just been said, in a way, because I said something, you know, banal about the position of women in the contemporary world and how crucial this is to political thinking. And I made a friend for life with Hillary Clinton, who's you know, I think, you know, very admirably, one of her missions in life is to promote the condition of women across the world. And then, if you're interested in these anecdotes, I know Amitai's probably got more than I have, but the second meeting was in the White House, and I was sitting opposite Bill Clinton at the height of the Monica Lewinsky affair, next to Hillary Clinton, Tony Blair on the other side, Al Gore on the other side. I looked at the Washington Monument, I thought, God, this is a surreal experience. It can't really be happening. But it did happen, and you know, the things that went on there, I think, did actually influence the climate of politics, because they led to a whole series of public meetings centered around, essentially, transformation of social democracy. I mean, the Third Way debate was mentioned. Well, Third Way has been regularly traduced in the British press, but for me, the Third Way is essentially how you update social democratic thinking in the face of the massive changes transforming the world. The emergence of a global economy, which I assure you, when I first sort of became interested in British politics in the early 1990s, nobody seemed interested in the globalization debate, but we got them interested. Second, the rise of a new knowledge economy. Only 16% of the labor force now employed in manufacture, fantastic transformation. Third, the rise of modern individualism, big changes to which I felt all political parties had to respond. I mean, I was lucky because this became, in a way, a global debate. There's been a global debate about these issues. So, I think I don't want to claim these things are just my invention, but you can have, I think, a very significant impact on the climate of opinion surrounding politics. And I feel this is not the kind of this is kind of the sociology which was maybe described as bad sociology. It does a lot of damage. Well, I'm lucky to have done a certain amount of damage through it, because this is more the impact of social theory, rather than precision or the sorts of things that were just talked about. And I think this is very, very important, because if you sort out what's happening in the world, and you get those who have power to understand or even take an interest in these changes, you're halfway towards producing fairly dramatic transformation of politics. And for me, the success of New Labour is not based on PR. It's not based on Peter Mandelson. It's based on the fact that there was a policy-rich agenda built up around these issues, which essentially also argued that if you're going to be a modern social democratic party, you must address issues which leftists have been reluctant to address in the past: crime, migration, sovereignty, the international scene. The result of this, I think, of this transformation of thinking, to which I feel it contributed a small bit, is that Labour edged the Tories out towards the margins. If New Labour is still in a strong position in spite of Iraq and all the problems around Tony Blair, it's because it squarely occupied this centre ground and produced a sort of a transformation of social democratic politics. Not everybody likes it, but it is the condition, I think, of the fact that New Labour is still, in spite of all these travails, quite likely to win the next election. And just in closing, I would affirm that this is a government which has a strong interest in social research and listens to the results of it. It's a government which established the strategy unit. The strategy unit, which I worked in for a while earlier this year, is full of people doing good work. If you're a sociologist who want to influence government, join up with the strategy unit if you can, because they've had a terrific discussion of social mobility, in which they used all the Oxford research, very intensively discussed. Strangely enough, after 100 years, they've all come round to the Max Weber idea of life chances, but it's not a bad idea, and it's kind of manifestly informing government policy. It's informing the fact that the government now is putting a lot of money into very early education of children. It's informing the fact that the Blair idea, education is not sufficient, because a lot of class inequalities are laid down well before children get to school. There will be a big investment in early care for children. Policy making in this sense has made a big, big impact, I think, on this government, and not always in a way which I would necessarily approve of, but I think, this is a manifest feature of the current government, that it does pay a lot of attention to social research and is very largely guided by its impact. In conclusion, all sociology is controversial, so the controversies of sociology are imported into these political arenas. I got really hit by Pierre Bourdieu for even being close to the government at all, because Bourdieu thought that intellectuals must always be critical. They must always question power. They mustn't work alongside power, but I don't accept that view.
Well, first of all, thanks for a generous introduction. I must explain that the White House, for which I was a senior advisor, was the Carter White House.
Yes. Very quick.
In this day and age, it's kind of important to make that clear. And let me also say that I'm lucky that I'm following Tony Ups, Lord Giddens, because much of what I wanted to say he said, and said very well. Let me just then make two observations. First, I think there's something profoundly flawed in the model, which seems to be somewhere in the air here, that if you do good technical sociology and you do your chi-square or your regression analysis and do a really good study with a good sample and gun control group, and you go to the right officer in the right cabinet ministry, and then they will listen to you, they change the policy recommendation, and then the minister will see if they, he or she can mix it with politics. What is flawed in this model is the confusion between analytical disciplines and interactive disciplines, integrative disciplines. Let me explain this for a moment. The thing about policy is having to deal with the elephant with all his four legs. If you move only one of the legs, the other three are not going to be happy. So you can deal only with economics, or only with sociology, or only with law, or only political science. You have to deal with all the major elements of policy. Now then, when you're in one of the many analytical disciplines, and you basically say, I'm going to assume that all the other subsystems hold constant while I'm studying mine, and I'm not going to worry about the interaction effect between my subsystem and the others, somebody else is going to worry about it. Now, even when we try at the end of business school, ask people who were taking classes in economics and in human relations and such to integrate in the last week of the before they graduate, they find it impossible to do that because the different analytical disciplines have very different incompatible assumptions. So the notion that you can move from five analytical disciplines to one unified policy science is a profound mistake. The way, if you want to be in policy science, look at medicine. When you get sick, you wouldn't dream of calling a professor of genetics or chemistry, I hope not. You're going to call a doctor. What marks the doctor? He's not profoundly knowledgeable about genetics. Or any of he knows a little of each. Therefore, he's able to draw on them. He knows how to combine them. And he has a lot of practical knowledge, which is not derivable from any analytical discipline. That's where international schools or international relations differ from a political science department, from sociology, economics department. If you want to be in policy science, you have to get off this 11th century map of sociology, economics, and so on, and start worrying about how you're going to integrate the findings of various disciplines, all speaking to the same policy, not marginally, but profoundly, and above all, how to integrate the finding based on different assumptions. The only other comment I want to make is I'm all in favor, I think. I'll fight for your right to spend your life as, I rather call this sociology in the public service than public sociology. There's a need for that, I think, and good to be done. When I hear the word public sociologist, I think about something very different. I do speak about people who, first of all, think about the public. A creature wasn't mentioned here much, because part of the process is normative and political. So when we go out there and speak to the public and say, we cannot have an international system which is so illegitimate. We cannot have devolution whose goes only to the level of Scotland and Welsh. That's not devolution. Devolution has to go down to the level of community. And then we are not talking only or even mainly to those in the seat of power. We realize that they are not living in a vacuum, that we have to bring along the public, educate, mobilize, build coalitions. That is what one of the things a public sociologist does. She speaks to the public, not just to those in the seats of power. And Tony and others, and me occasionally, had a voice out there which helped pave the way. In effect, the public sociologist has to pave the way. It makes no sense to go to a politician, however courageous, and say, go out there in the blue yonder and try a policy which everybody opposes. If we can show that we can find legs for it in legitimacy, then maybe we can get them out of their prefixed notions. Now, one other thing, I agree with Tony, you don't have to speak close to power. You sometimes speak from the inside, although often you do speak from the outside. But there's one thing which you find both inside and outside, and that is public leaders and the citizens tend to lock into community of assumptions. The world is very threatening when there are all these details which don't make sense. That's why I don't listen carries, too detailed. What you need is to see what is this gestalt in which people take for granted. For 30 years, the United States, citizens and government took it for granted the Soviet Union is a terribly powerful country. And we spent trillions in energy and on the assumption you couldn't say it wasn't true. Finally, when China broke away with Russia, the American press and media and politicians said it wasn't true, that somebody was making this up to fool us. And then finally, it took Kissinger those days was a professor of Harvard. He said, you know what, there is something there. So prying open the community of assumptions, being critical in that sense, to open the world to new thoughts. We're running around now saying, don't say Muslims. They're not all of one kind. There are Muslims in Indonesia, in Bangladesh, in Kyrgyzstan, who are very moderate, they're very much what we want, so on. Don't go around and make everybody a jihadist. Well, it doesn't take 20 years of sociological research to come to that insight. We take 20 years of public sociology to get the public to listen to that, and then hopeful the politician will dare change course. Once you are in one of those rare occasions where these public blindfolders break open, then there's an opportunity, like what you did the Third Way and others, to introduce a new gestalt, a new way to formulate and frame things, so we can think about them, the way community responsibility and opportunity for while was. One last example. I'm at the moment trying to explain people what legitimacy is. Now, I mean, you can look it up in the dictionary. It's not badly defined. International law can talk about it, moralists can talk about it. There is a sociological dimension to it, which is as good an example as I can give. The sociological knowledge, which is kind of distilled combination of facts, interpretations, allows you to say the following. You're surrounded with people who claim they're realists. And they think what you should count is barrel of oils and number of troops and nuclear weapons. And they scoff at ideas and international law and institutions. But you know, legitimacy has real consequences in the language, in the coinage you recognize. So when the United States in the war in the Gulf in 1991 paid for 20% of the cost, and this time it paid for 110% of the cost, this is real money. This is not just ideas. And when the United States lost in South Korea, its ally, because the South Koreans did not support the war in Iraq, that had real consequences now in the negotiation with North Korea. And I just want to use it to give it a flavor of the kind of conversations which are the most consequential. I'm not belittling at all readjusting the policy on how we deal with juvenile delinquents or how we run family courts. They all have their place. They are based, in my judgment, on policy analysis, not on monodiscipline analysis. But don't forget talking to the public and talking to the community of assumptions. One last observation, because I very much hope at least one or two of you will choose that life. It ain't happy. So let me make you clear about that. First of all, don't expect anybody to kiss you on both cheeks or any other place. First of all, the first one who's going to pee on you are going to be your fellow sociologists, because you are becoming a popularizer. And if you read up, and that's a very interesting experiment I did do, if you look at any scientist, social or otherwise, who spoke publicly, they get that. Carl Sagan got it, Gould got it, anybody who dares speak to the public gets immediately criticized for not having done the chi-squares and not having enough footnotes. And it's true. It's a valid criticism. When we say these things, we don't qualify them as much as you could. We don't give them a lot of footnotes. We don't mention everybody else who said that before, which is academically wrong. There is a built-in tension here. But let me say, when I looked at this, it took me long enough to discover that. I did speak often with too much emotion, with too much moral message, too generally. But my sociology got better in the process, because there is a danger in the academic sociology to become marginal and irrelevant. I'm not saying you should choose your topics by relevancy. It's one consideration. But it's nice to once in a while hear a voice that when somebody studies the pause in phone calls, why do some people pause longer in phone calls than others? Or when they say, that there are other topics which you can make as good chi-squares about them, and they have more public consequence.
Thank you. Well, you've been told about the highs and the lows, by the sounds of it, of being successful. There are quite a few young sociology students here, a few not so young ones as well. Can I ask Tony and Amitai what they would commend these younger scholars to be doing in order to be noticed both by government and also by the public? Tony, can you do that, please?
Catherine, please.
She's going to speak. She's
Well, I mean, you know, lots of issues floating around in this, really. I think one is the relationship between universities, think tanks, and the media. There's no doubt the climate of the relationship between these has changed over the last sort of 20 years because of the immediacy of information. So universities do most of the basic research, which allows think tanks and consultancies to flourish, and I think a lot of that is hidden away. So when I was at the LSE, I certainly encouraged people to become what Amitai was saying, public intellectuals who are prepared to address a wider public. Not all academics are either keen to do that or are actually all that good at it. It is quite difficult to do, I think. But I think if you want to have an impact on government, you have to have an impact on the wider public too. And to do that, as has been said by, I think, all the contributors here, you have to speak a different language from just the academic language of academic discourse. And I think one of the things for me is that sociologists haven't done this enough, because you look at the Guardian newspaper, example, and you open the weekend section of the Guardian newspaper, most of the articles in there are essentially sociological topics about the family or cities, urban decay, so forth and so forth, but you don't find too many academic sociologists contributing. And I personally, I think more should. So in spite of the fact that you tend to get excommunicated by the academic community, as Amitai says, if you engage with a wider audience, I strongly believe that more sociologists should do so and take the plunge.
What I'm going to say next may sound like a lame joke. It ain't. You either get yourself adopted, his parents have a trust fund, or get tenure first. The reason is it's not a very secure job track to be a public intellectual, and I think fair warning is due to those who will, and I agree with Tony that not everybody should feel they have to respond to that calling. But if you hear that calling, and you'll hear it if you hear it, take a deep breath, because I started at my first year at Columbia University, and I started by demonstrating Trafalgar Square against nuclear weapons and writing against the danger of miscalculation by people who have control over nuclear weapons. And I was called by the chairman of my department, and he told me that arguably I had some talent for sociology, but if I wouldn't cut out that social work, I should start packing. And, you know, I had a year-old child, I had $300 to my name, and it wasn't very pleasant. So now, 2 years later, I got tenure by doing more footnotes than anybody should ever do. If you look at the comparative analysis of complex organizations, I look at 1,100 studies, I got tenure, and from then on, they didn't stop me very well. I'm serious. It's not an easy track to follow. But meanwhile, I recommend even more seriously, read widely. Sociology has some wonderful books, but they're not all written by sociologists, you know. And there's some political theory which I find very worth reading. And there's John Rawls, and there's a lot of good stuff going under other disciplines, depending on what part of sociology you want to go into. So I recommend that you will not, precisely because the world is not boxed in analytical boxes, that you get a sense of how people approach it when they live in other parts of the world. Let me give a very brief example. This afternoon we had a wonderful conversation upstairs on my little book, and a professor of international law asked me, so how come Americans don't play by the rules? And we had a very interesting conversation about that, because there was an implicit social theory behind what he was saying, that people somehow live by the rules, you know, they kind of are born this way, or they come to go to finishing school and they learn that gentlemen play by the rules. Well, Americans are not gentlemen, but I don't know. But it was, I had a hard time figuring out what was the theory behind the notion that people as a rule, or as, my answer was sociological, I think, is you have first to get people to share your values, because rules are the continuation of values by other means. And that may be getting much too far afield. All I'm saying to you, if you want to prepare yourself for public dialogue, read more widely, than only the sociological terms.
Thank you. There's another area I wanted to cover before we open the debate out, and that is that another area where sociologists are seen not to be fulfilling the role they could is in holding governments to account, in particular to democratic account. Paul Johnson, for example, in his BJS article, commented that very many of the hundreds of academics working in education don't really hold government to critical account on education policy in the way that they might. Now, Tessa hasn't been forgotten. I wanted Tessa to address this point in particular because I think she's eminently well qualified to address the point. Tessa became Vice Chancellor of the University of Greenwich in September this year. Previously, she taught at the LSE. She was Master of Birkbeck, a member of the Central Policy Review staff, a Minister of State for Education and Employment, Minister for the Arts, and was a member of the Privy Council and House of Lords. I should add that in all cases on this panel, I've had to abbreviate greatly the CV. But Tessa, I wanted to ask you if you think that sociologists do let politicians off lightly by not calling them to account. Is that your experience?
Well, can I come on to that in a moment and just make some more general comments about some of the other things that have been said? First of all, I'd say to Tony, there are more jokes about politicians and bad jokes about politicians than sociologists and economists put together. Public opinion surveys always show that politicians come out right at the bottom in terms of social esteem. I started my life as an academic sociologist, but I moved away from it for, I think, three reasons. One, because I became interested in social action. Two, because I became interested in public policy. And ultimately, three, because I became interested in politics. And I didn't think remaining as an academic sociologist was going to allow me to fulfill any kind of meaningful role in any of those areas. And it actually was rather easier, perhaps, to do that when I was working as a young academic in the late 60s and 70s, and up to the mid-late 70s. Than it was subsequently, when I think that the social sciences and sociology in particular completely lost their way with reference to playing any kind of part in influencing the way in which debates took place in government, influencing the way in which people who made important decisions thought. Now, this was partly due to a right-wing Thatcherite government led by a conviction politician, Margaret Thatcher, who really had no time for any of this. I wrote a little book on the Central Policy Review staff some years ago, which was an inside government think tank, actually set up by a conservative regime, by Ted Heath's government in the early 1970s, to advise ministers on all aspects of policy, and I was actually a member of that group. So I was an advisor in the Wilson-Callaghan government, which I think goes back even earlier than the Carter government, just revealing my age perhaps as well as yours. However, when we asked Margaret Thatcher why she abolished the Central Policy Review staff, she said, oh, I had no time for all that guff, too many PhD theses. Now, that in a sense encapsulates in a rather crude way how many politicians, and particularly politicians of the right, regard academia. I in no way want to give it an endorsement. It doesn't deserve any kind of endorsement. But I do actually think that social scientists in this country and perhaps elsewhere too have to take some of the blame for the sort of cut-off that took place. Now, if we look at what happened since 1997, when you had a Labour government coming in after 18 years in opposition with a lot of ideas and a lot of commitments about what it wanted to do and much more of an open-minded approach to allowing social research to influence how they thought. I still don't think, I regret to say, that it's worked very well, and I agree very much with what both Philip and Paul have said about this and some of their reasons for why it hasn't worked. But let me say, I spent 5 years as a principal opposition spokesman in the House of Lords before coming into government, where I was responsible for foreign policy. And I used to read quite a bit of the international relations work that was being done at that time, but I would say I was extremely unusual in doing so. I would say that very few of my colleagues in the Labour Party who were opposition spokesmen ever did this, because it was too far away from what they needed in order to play their role in holding it to account the government of the day. I can honestly say in my 6 years as a minister, I never encountered a single sociologist who wrote to me saying, I've done this piece of research. I think that it would be very valuable for you to perhaps have a look at it, or perhaps I could meet you. I'm not saying I would have responded positively to the proposal, but honestly, it never happened. And so I just want to endorse what Paul said, is that social scientists have not made a sufficient effort, and sociology in particular, in getting into government and in drawing the attention of people who work in government to their work. It has to be a two-way process, this, not just people from government trying to look out. So I do think there's a need to be much more proactive and not as simply reactive to what is done. And there's quite a lot of criticism from social scientists in media, in specialist journals and so on. It's very depressing for those who are involved in decision making to sit and have to absorb criticism when there was no positive input at the beginning. So that's a real plea from the heart for people to, in a sense, get off their backsides and get in there. And I do very much agree with what Tony was saying. People should take the plunge. People should get involved as citizens and as people who have a unique set of understanding and knowledge which ought to be brought to bear to some of these issues. And I don't think enough of it is done at the moment. I've also spent quite a bit of my life as a social scientist being involved with think tanks. And think tanks have displaced what is happening in many academic sociology departments, simply because they are prepared to take that plunge, to get in there, to try to find solutions to the problems that people in government face every day. I have to admit that never for a moment till I became a member of the Blair government did I imagine just how difficult it is to be a minister. And those of you who work in the civil service as researchers will understand what I'm saying. The pressures on you are incredible. I mean, first of all, huge pressures of time. You work a 14-hour day. You are accountable. You're accountable to Parliament. You're accountable to the press and the media, who are extremely difficult to deal with. You're accountable to your constituents, if you're an elected member of the government. You're accountable to your colleagues. A hell of a lot of what goes on in government is about interchange between different government departments, all of which have their own agendas, their own ethos, and their own commitments to particular things which may be in conflict and inconsistent with those of other departments. So there's a lot of effort and time that goes into cabinet committees where all these things get thrashed out. So you don't get very much time for reflection. So other people need to do the reflection for you. Again, when I was writing my book on the think tank, another one of the people that I interviewed with my co-author was Tony Benn. He said we don't need think tanks because we can all do our own thinking. Utter crap, rubbish. I love Tony, but he does talk a whole lot of nonsense, and this is a very good example of it. For all his good brains, he never had time to do enough thinking. Actually, if he'd had a bit more time, he would have thought more sensibly, maybe. But it is very, very necessary for other people to help those who live this rather stressful and demanding life as a minister, or indeed as a permanent secretary or very senior civil servant, where you have to do an endless balancing act between a whole lot of conflicting pressures and conflicting policies that you're involved with trying to sort out. On the point that Tony was making about being able to influence climate and rather than specific policy, I agree with that, and you can do it. The only reservation I have about this is that climate's change, fashions come and go, and that's true about ideology and about approaches which take a kind of broad overview. And I think that there is a lot of advantage in social sciences not focusing too much on that, but concentrating a lot more on specific areas of policy. And I see my old friend Shelley Horsey in the front of the audience. I think that the work that he did in the late 1950s and the 1960s on social selection, masquerading as academic selection, at the outset of secondary education, I'm talking about the 11 plus, was hugely more influential in a long-term sense because it led to the development of common schooling in secondary education in a lasting way, even though there are some modifications and changes being made to it, but the principle has not gone, and it didn't go right through 18 years of Tory rule. So I just give that as an example of where I think it is very important to try and get into specific policy making. If I could just pick up on what Amitai Tsioni said, I agree with him that it is enormously important if social sciences are working for government not to be in silos. Again, people need answers to difficult questions, and they don't want to hear one particular set of answers on one aspect of a problem from economists and a totally different take on this from sociologists and another one from psychologists. That integration is absolutely vital if it's to be of value for people who have to make decisions. My very last point is that I think that in foreign policy making, which I gather you're now involved in, it is particularly difficult to actually have any impact, however high quality your research is, because there is so little evidence-based decision making. Too much foreign policy is actually about politics and power struggles. Very little of it is terribly rational. I'm going to end with a very provocative point. If we'd had really good rational decision making with a proper consideration of all that we know about the Middle East and the wider world of Islam, we would have not invaded Iraq. I want to finally say that I will give Amitai a kiss on both cheeks if he is able to find a way of introducing more evidence-based thinking into the making of foreign policy. Thank you.
Tessa, there was one more question I wanted to ask you. That is, do you think that your training as a sociologist and your experience as being a sociological researcher influence the sorts of evidence that you asked for and the sorts of work that you were looking at when you were a minister?
Well, all the people who taught me here will have failed if it didn't. Yes, of course, I do think it. Of course it did. And it continues to influence me. I used to sit with senior officials in both the departments that I worked in as a minister, and I would constantly say, this piece of policy thinking that you produced in this paper you put out doesn't answer the key questions that you should be looking at. It doesn't give me enough information about what the impact of this will be on different social groups. It doesn't tell me enough about what the effect of these changes will be over time. All these questions need to be asked. But I have to say also, and I have to make an admission here, I was thought, I suspect, and well, I know, by some of my colleagues to be much too academic in how I approach these issues. I was also thought in Parliament to be academic, sometimes too academic, in how I debated issues or answered questions. Again, we have to come back to a point made earlier about discourse. The discourse of the academic social sciences is a very long way from the discourse of politics. And unless there can be an attempt for them to meet halfway, this terrible gap will continue to exist. A lot of sociological writing, I think, is appalling. It's inaccessible. It's unclear often, even to people who have been trained as I have a long time ago, and I'm not at all up to date with a lot of recent work, but I can guarantee that I could sit down, not late at night when I'm tired, but first in the morning when I'm feeling bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I could read some articles, even from the British Journal of Sociology, and I'd think, what the hell is all of this about? And I don't think that that will be terribly helpful in the longer run. People have got to write with greater clarity and with greater thought, not to their own little tiny world of the people who are not just other sociologists, but people in their own specialisation in sociology, if you want to have any impact.
Thank you. Tony, you've been itching.
Well,
I wanted to first ask Hugh and maybe Chelly if they wanted to reflect on what's been said thus far, and then open it through.
I think it's got three points to make, and it really takes up on the point that Tess has made, but everyone else has made as well. And that is, I think that if you're going to communicate clearly, but with a degree of integrity in terms of what you're doing, you have to be on top of your game. You have to know your area absolutely as an expert, and there's no way out of that. And I think that that is a prerequisite for understanding how you can distill complex theory and data into something that others beyond your own discipline, as it were, can understand. So I think that's the first point to make, which means that you can't just go out and write popular books. You have to, as it were, have mastered, it's a sexist term, but be on top of the area that you're working in. The second thing that you're going to go and influence policymakers, even if they are kind enough to give you a hearing, there is a degree, I think Paul made this point, of serendipity about this. Your research and the timing in terms of a wider audience, whether it be, as it were, the citizens of the country, or whether it be policymakers, that is a matter of serendipity to a large extent, I think. And I think there's a third point to be made here, and it's a point that was touched on by Phil, Paul, and Tessa in different ways, Phil and Paul in the same way. And that is, they talked about a shortage of skills, and they talked about it in terms of quantitative skills in particular. But even if you're excellent at being able to integrate quantitative and qualitative skills, if you haven't got some kind of theoretical sophistication in terms of theory development, theory testing, and this comes to Tessa's point about integration, in terms of judgment as to which are the best competing theories out there at that time, then that is a major disservice that's done both to policymakers and to the general public that you might be wishing to address. So that sophistication cannot just be nuts and bolts stuff. And Phil has a splendid piece at the end of his paper where he says, well, actually, this is what it looks like. This is the sorts of skills and understandings, theories and knowledge you need to be helpful. And it really is an extraordinary, sophisticated set of demands that are being made. And of course, no one human being can achieve them all. But I think it's a cognizance of the fact that we should be trying to achieve a little bit more. Amitai's point about wide reading. Wide reading is absolutely essential to all this, to understand how we can integrate different aspects of the problem that we're dealing with, globalization, whatever it happens to be in that particular context. So it seems to me that there is something else that the ESRC should be taking into account here, and that is that in terms of their MRESs for various forms of research training, if there's a gap, I think, that really needs to be addressed, and that is theoretical sophistication. It's not just the nuts and bolts activity. And that raises an issue that Chelly and I and Phil Brown talk about in the paper, and that is this asymmetry, possible asymmetry, between that kind of theoretical and empirical sophistication on the one hand, and policymakers who might have their own ideas as to how they want to explain particular data, phenomena, evidence that they've got. And I think at that point, that's when a more democratic debate has to be joined as to what are the competing explanations for a particular phenomena, a particular problem, and then either that influences policymakers, or at least you can get it out into the media, get it out into some kind of public debate. So the areas that we're talking about is this odd mixture, on the one hand, of theoretical sophistication, being on top of your game in terms of what you do, and on the other hand, knowing that for years, or perhaps never, the influence you're likely to have is going to be quite remote. But there is an element of serendipity there as well.
Thank you. Chelly, did you want to add a comment?
Well, yes. Can I stay seated?
Yes, of course, yes. You can.
I remember rather vividly, I've been thinking about it while I've sat here, that there was a previous occasion when I sat in this particular seat and listened to David Glass in 1950 talking about the future of sociology and assuming at all points in his lecture that the major destination of sociology students, and he's thinking of undergraduates, would be Westminster Whitehall and not academia. I was very sold on that idea myself, and I think so were the few of us who were sitting in that detention listening to this inaugural lecture. And I'd like to ask the panel, what happened, particularly with reference to what you have been talking about, i.e. the connection between theoretical sophistication and, shall we say, the drive towards policy clear solution. What has happened in the university to produce the kind of gloom that you have generated, that things are not at all well in the social sciences in general, and sociology in particular, with respect to the continuation of what I would have called the glass dream in retrospect?
Thank you. If I could just take a few questions, the collective questions, I think that would be quite a good thing to do at the moment. Are there any broader questions? The lady up here on, yeah. Here, look.
Hello, I just wanted to ask the panel if they thought there was any room for other professions, such as medical doctors with an interest in sociology, if they had a role in public policy making, and what it would be.
And another question in the front here, if you can put down the hand here.
I just wanted to return once more to the title of the event tonight, Public Sociology, Sociology and the Democratic Debate. Now, it occurs to me that both public and democratic aren't the same as government. The discourse tonight has been a very pragmatic one, and I do see that most jobs would be related to government or academia. But if one asks the question, what is the role of sociology within public debate, I think we have to do better than we have done tonight. One distinction that hasn't really been made very clearly, and maybe it's one that we should reflect on, is the distinction between academic and scientific. I think academic discourses are one thing, I think scientific discourses are another, and sociology is a substantive discipline, but it is also a science. And as a science, it has a contribution to make to both its publics and to the democratic process. Now, what is that contribution that sociology as a science can make to that process? And if necessary, against government? I would like to ask this as an open question, but I would be very grateful to have some answers on this, because I think this should be the core of any debate at a university that wants to find out what sociology can contribute to society, not government.
Okay, the lady in the red here.
Hi, my name's Andrea and I used to study social policy. I just finished an MSc here, and before that and now I work around drug policy, and I want to ask a question which is about a public policy which affects millions of people. And Tessa said something about something, I can't remember the exact words, but in the area of foreign policy, egos and power structures and all the rest of it cause a huge amount of problems. And what I found, both as a practitioner in the drugs field, as somebody who's directly affected by both AIDS and addiction, and God knows how many people I've buried, is that actually what's happening now is not only do drug users not give a damn what your laws are saying, I'm speaking here your as in generic governments, but also the people themselves who are trying to save lives no longer care. And this seems to me to be, anarchy is not the right word, but there is something critically wrong with this situation when there is a public policy, which is now global, which is sustained by criminality, etc., etc., etc. I'm sure most people in this room have heard these arguments 1,000 times. And there are economists here who also will be aware that there is enough scientific base now to know that the economics of this is all upside down also. And I think to myself, well, you know, it makes me feel desperate. Any comments would be gratefully received. Thanks.
Thank you. I think we have a few large questions there, which may keep the panel occupied. Who would like to start? Phil's
done. Yeah, I don't know if we can do all of them at once. I'll try. First of all, just to show that, certainly where I'm coming from, we don't want to be philistine about what sociology is, and I wanted to reiterate a number of things about theory. First of all, I had a very depressing discussion with colleagues, Paul doesn't know this, in the Treasury, when we were trying to discuss why economists take it more seriously than social researchers in government. One of the economists there, a very senior economist, said, well, Phil, that's because you've got no theories. It's a stunning thing to say that there are no social theories. You know, I'm sitting next to two of the great social theorists of the world either side of me. I mean, there's an enormous amount of theory. The point is, our theory doesn't quite cut the ice somehow, and I don't know why that is. And it might go to Celli's point as well about where the vision has gone, because I think somehow, and also to Etienne's point about the lack of legitimacy, there's some things not linking up there. It goes to the last point about drugs policy as well, is that we don't just lack that legitimacy in terms of the theories that that bind our work together. We've actually lost legitimacy with practitioners, and it's a real problem. Now, I had hoped, and I still hope, that evidence-based policy has significance as much for evidence for practitioners, which is to say people involved with drugs, drug treatments, with teachers, with the early contribution about the medical profession. It's very important that we actually make those theories relevant. Go back to C. Wright Mill's important contribution all those years ago, that we cannot just have abstract empiricism. If we do that, we're lost. And it could be that's what we've done. We've made our theory too impenetrable, and our abstract empiricism, frankly, quite boring, and often actually also terribly imprecise. And that's a blight on us, if those two points are true. The academic versus scientific point, I think which is an excellent point, this gentleman here, I think that also goes to this point that the academic world needs to have grounded theories, and perhaps the scientific world is more concerned with methodology. And I do this myself. I get really obsessed by methodology. That's partly my job, is to raise the standards of methods and research in government. And if you try to talk about the contribution of theories and ideas, there isn't a welcome audience there. I know there's maybe a more general point there that theorizing isn't a great British thing. French seem to be much better at theorizing and seem to get better reputation for it. And then we have to say, what sort of theorizing do we like? Something we're trying to do in the Cabinet Office very clearly is to bring theorizing in at the beginning of policy. And it's what we call the challenge function. It's to get people to challenge ministers. We challenge ministers about what is the underlying theory, the logic model, if you like, the theory of change by which you get from a policy input to the outcomes of this contributor, this lady here, which is talking about people dying from drugs. That's a sort of dramatic outcome. And if you look at that link in a logical model or a theoretical model, it is hopeless. But we don't have joined up theory. We don't have careful thinking. And that's important. I just want to stress that we're not just here to be, as I say, philistine methodologists. We do need to improve methodology. And one thing I loved about Hugh and Charlie and Philip's paper was that they said we've got to bind these ideas around with good theory. And I don't think anybody here, even the eminent people here who have been brilliant theorists, have really taught us how to do that and how to make that publicly accessible. And I think that's the major challenge for where we go for the different questions here from the floor.
One brief comment about a difference between economists and sociologists. And I will not tell a joke. The economists in the United States made a survey and asked the members of the discipline if they agreed on a certain set of tenets, such for instance, free trade is important, and there was an enormous consensus. This is inconceivable in sociology. So the fact that there's very little, even the most basic observations, which you can assume all sociologists, or most of them, would sign off on, is one thing which hinders us. Sociology is more fragmented than practically any other discipline. I want to go back just for 1 minute to this question of theory, and this phrase keeps coming up, evidence-based something. Look, I was on my second day in the White House, and the President Carter called us in and said he wanted us to write a brochure, which he would send to every American. By the way, together with a piece of plastic he could put in the shower to reduce the use of calories. And the brochure would have to explain, only facts please, no normative stuff, no politics, that there's a limited amount of oil in the world, and given the rate we were spending it, there's going to be no oil left, and therefore they had to change their behavior. And I tried to say to the Mr. President, excuse me, but you know, that brochure God couldn't write. But you know, he wouldn't listen to it. Anyhow, why was I so sure? Use our language, formal communications is not going to work. That it wasn't just a question of a lot of facts. Well, if you want, I can cite this study done on whatever, on UNESCO, or this study done on mental patients in Illinois. But it's really something different. It's where we take a large variety of studies and certain concepts we have of how people change, how people relate to each other, and we distill them into a few propositions. And we don't at that moment say, Mr. President, if I read you this study done by Lenore on an incomplete sample, we have this distillation. So I want you to take into account that between the evidence-based stuff and what you share with the public and the politician is that theory, if you mean by that, the distillation of our insight and such. One more thing, if I may. I'm so anxious not to lose the opportunity to get two kisses on my cheeks. I like to suggest one very productive area for interface between sociology and foreign policy, which I tried to make a minor contribution, and that is the notion that countries can march into other countries and change their regimes, that you can make them into flourishing democracies, that you can change their HIV behavior, that you can eliminate poverty. A lot of things, some of them are motivated by ill motives, oil, and some by very noble motives. But behind all of them is a theory that you can march into a country and change it quickly. And I think it would save a lot of grief to everybody concerned if you can show them how difficult it is to change a country, how much commitment it takes, how much has been involved the local population. I'll close by this one line here. I just went to a prize-winning dinner in Washington where Charles Krauthammer got the prize. He's the leading neocon. And he said that he was breaking with the neocons, the neoconservatives, because they wanted to democratize the world. He wanted to democratize only the Middle East.
Thank you. Tessie, you can tell him if he gets a kiss later without us all listening. But do you think maybe you could pick up on some of the questions?
Yes, let me pick up one or two of them. I'm starting in the order they were put. On David Glass's dream, it's a very difficult question to answer, but I suspect that what happened in the 1960s was a huge expansion of the social sciences, where able young social scientists were sucked into academia. I don't think if I'd been born 10 years earlier or 10 years later, I would probably have become an academic, but the opportunities were there, and many of us were on a kind of escalator, and we were excited by what we were doing. And we did our doctorates and we got jobs here or wherever and stayed in it. So in my generation, many of us didn't go into Westminster and Whitehall because of all these opportunities to continue as professional social scientists, people like Paul Rock, who was one of my peer group back in the early 1960s here. And I suppose that I'm rather unusual in that I broke out of that and did what David Glass wanted to see happen. I went into Whitehall and later I went into Westminster. But I think it's partly that the way sociology developed in the late 70s and 1980s took us right away from the kind of approach that people like David Glass had to the study of sociology, which was at least in part about solving problems and using sociological knowledge and understanding and the methods of social research to increase our understanding. I mean, in his case, it applied in particular to demographic problems and problems of population growth and change. And we seem to move right away from that into ethnomethodology and other areas of social theory, which would not have prepared people terribly well for a role in Westminster and Whitehall, where you could grapple with the minutiae of policy making, taking research that you'd done and then applying it to some of the issues that governments were struggling to resolve. On the question from the person up in the balcony, I'm sort of struggling with what lies behind it, but I suspect it's the sort of critique of government and the feeling that we've all spent too much time thinking about how we should be helping government as social scientists rather than being critics of government. I think that both roles need to be played, and I think that sociologists will be more accepted as critics of government, doing some of the holding to account that Bridget was referring to, if they get engaged as well. Otherwise they just look like a lot of outsiders, rather like the press, voyeurs, who can sit writing nasty, rude articles about why it's all going wrong, but have never, ever had to make a decision about how to make it go right, and never come up with a positive proposal as to how to make it go right. So I genuinely do feel that there isn't a huge distinction between these roles, that they can go together, and one will draw on the other, and people would be much more effective critics if they actually know a bit about how the real world works, and knowing how the real world works involves getting engaged with it.
Yeah, just a couple of points very briefly. I think this point about the relative role of sociology and economics is an important one, and I think the point about essentially the simplicity or simplisticness, if you like, of economics is terribly, terribly important in this. There are a dozen basic, incredibly powerful and very simple ideas in economics which drive a great deal. Actually, you can make a career. I have kind of just continued repeating these 12 things about the importance of incentives, the importance of competition and productivity and so on. And it works, and it's important, and it's made a great big difference to government. And sociology is just so damn difficult to kind of get hold of. What are they? What would those 12 things be? Maybe they should be, the next role for Tony and others on the panel to kind of set this out, because it is much harder for policymakers to grab hold of that, and indeed for sociologists to agree on it. And I think that's a key issue to address. Chelly asked about kind of what happened to create all this gloom. As I said to begin with, let's not be too gloomy. There really is a great deal of policy that's happened and is happening that is fundamentally influenced by what social scientists have found out about the nature of poverty and inequality and social mobility and education and welfare to work and all these kinds of things. There's a great deal, that is good. Why isn't there more? Why isn't there more kind of going into in public policy? Things the SRC and others might want to think about is a PhD is a training for academia. It is not a training, in this country at least, for much else besides. There is a serious question about whether that's the right thing to spend 3 years doing if you're interested in public policy. There isn't a demand even, really, within government for people with PhDs because of the very specialised nature of the training that it gives. So maybe there's a question about the kind of training that goes on after the undergraduate level. There's also a question of the kinds of incentives that there are on academics, and particularly young academics. The point about distillation is really important. It's important for policy making, it's important for having an impact, but there are no incentives in academia to do that kind of distillation of the evidence. You don't get any kind of kudos for doing it. You don't get points in the research assessment exercise. I think that's a really kind of fundamental problem about the kind of incentives that people face. Finally, on the point about the role of academics in the democratic debate, I think it's absolutely crucial that people who are expert in areas are holding government to account, because you get worse policy if there's nobody out there who is informed and engaged who is holding departments to account. If departments know they're going to get held to account by people, A, who know what they're talking about, and B, are taken seriously, either by the political class or by the media as a whole, then they will take notice of it and they will change the way they behave. And there are parts of public policy which are like that, and there are very substantial parts of public policy which are not like that. So it's an absolutely crucial element of the role of the academic community. There's one actually where this point where think tanks have filled that role actually more effectively quite often than the academic community as a whole. And I think that's something that is a problem for government actually, that there are kind of debates between the departmental press office and the National Union of Teachers, or the departmental press office and some pressure group. There isn't a debate about but between those who are taking a view from the social science and expert perspective.
Can I just add something to what's just been said? And it relates the question about democracy and the question about drugs. Politicians and government, they're shaped very much by public opinion. They have to be, or they don't get re-elected in democracies. It's fine in a totalitarian regime. You can, on the whole, get away with doing what you want. But you can't in democracies. And I think that social scientists do have a role in trying to shape public opinion rather more than they've done. If we want to get better understanding about the criminal mafia, the global criminal mafia that is sustained by the current regime we have on the failure to allow the use of drugs and the making of drugs illegal, you have to actually explain to people what it means. Because the vast majority of people, if we went out into Kingsway and stopped 20 people, they wouldn't have a clue about it. And if you watch the American election and you see the things that people say in the sort of vox pops that we get, it's pretty terrifying. So there is a huge educational job to be done. I don't want to be too Reithian in what I'm saying. But everybody has a role, and everybody in this room has a role in trying to explain to people who haven't got the privileges that we have of time, study, knowledge, and so on, what the evidence tells us. And only then will we get more rational decision-making, because only then will it be possible for people who have to make these decisions to make them on that basis, rather than having to kowtow to ill-informed public opinion. Thank you, Tim.
Well, I guess it's thank you and good night. I mean, I'm no longer director of the LSE, but I do have a certain proprietorial interest in it, and I think very good questions from the audience and excellent performances from the panel. Very good LSE event. I mean, you might think all is sweetness and light on this panel, but it's not, because I think there's a pretty big disagreement, because I think the influence of, especially the social sciences, if you go beyond sociology, is much, much greater than most of the other panelists have been saying. I think it's absolutely massive. But a lot of it is actually subterranean. It doesn't come from someone simply going to talk to a politician and trying to get that politician to understand what structural social mobility means. It comes from a much more massive sort of formation of a particular framework. And I quite strongly disagree with what Tessa said about Thatcherism. Whatever Mrs. Thatcher herself might have said while she was speaking, I noted down the kind of impact of the social sciences on which gave Thatcherism its enormous power and appeal. One thing was the idea of the small state and the work political scientists did on state overload, for example. Another was the critique of comprehensive education, which sociologists were leaders in. Another was condition of competitiveness, flexible labour markets, very different from traditional Labour Party thinking. Another was Nozick on property, which might seem a long way from council and house ownership, but actually there was a direct connection between them. And a lot of what became Thatcherism was certainly very strongly influenced by sort of a morass of social scientific thinking. I think you'll never find a government in power for any period which is not in some sense informed by social scientific work. But a lot of it is a sort of subterranean influence rather than what a particular individual can persuade a particular politician to do. Just in closing, Chelly's comment, I mean, Chelly's produced best book on British sociology written very recently. It came out a year ago. It sort of charts the whole progress or otherwise of British sociology, and he's been such a major figure in it. And, you know, I think we should all pay tribute to the impact that he's had across the years. And I would have a sort of sequence of answers to the question he raised about what it was like when David Glass put these things forward and what it was like later. One would be the LSE. The LSE at that time was a more or less unrivaled position in British sociology. British sociology simply did not have the spread that they'd had in other universities. So when you talked at the LSE, you were already close, as it were, to the citizens of power, I think. The second would be Fabianism, as a kind of intellectual tradition to which you were such a distinguished contributor, also very strongly part of LSE's tradition, a political outlook associated with essentially reformist socialism, always, I think, quite closely integrated with sociological research. That was, I think, much more powerful at that time, much more politically prominent than it's later become, because it's been challenged by a lot of other perspectives. And third, I think the diversification of sociology, because at that time it was a much more clearly demarcated sort of arena for sociology, and for better or for worse, over the past 30 or so years, you get tremendous diversification of what sociology is. To some extent, it loses that central core, which is just being said still exists in economics, and you could say it's a bad thing or a good thing. But personally, I would say that although you might look back to that time and think, well, David Glass was training these people, you know, they wanted to go into government, I think a lot more sociologists actually in government, influencing government, and if I might say so, also influencing wider democratic debate in the society than there were at that time, even proportionately probably a greater number. But there is one puzzle which I would leave you with as a social theorist, which is, where have all the social theorists gone? Because, you know, the generation to which I belong, I think we look to the previous generation, amazing sort of diversity, you know, Goffman and all the others, for example, at Berkeley at one point, continental social theory. Then as my sort of generation, still quite a few of us sort of hanging on, floundering around, trying to understand the world. But where is the up-and-coming generation of social theorists? I'm not sure where they're on. Therefore, I'm not sure that social theory is making the impact on the public domain and the contribution to, after all, what is a key part of democracy, public dialogue. And I think there is something missing there, and we might all ponder on where that went and what we might do about it. Anyway, thanks to everyone for a very good debate.
Hugh, do you want to have a very quick last word? It would have to be brief.
Very quick, which is to say, I think I'll leave here greatly heartened by what I've heard tonight. I'll take Tony's last point, because when you think about some of the concepts and ideas that are now embedded in our normal discussions, notions of cultural capital, from Pierre Bourdieu, origins, indoctrinations, third wave, whatever it is, they're part of our general discussion and kind of say discourse. I think I've been greatly heartened from what I've heard from the people that are on the policy side tonight as well, in terms of, you know, trying to make government more rigorous in terms of its thinking about theory. As to Paul's dilemma, I know I've talked to new right people about neoclassical economics. Why is it so popular? Well, you can get an answer by a quick deduction. You just take it off the shelf. You don't actually need empirical research necessarily. And whether we can do equal that with any kind of probity, I have no idea.
Thank you. Well, BJS doesn't expect this to be the end of the debate. We were hoping to stimulate it and kick it back into action, so we hope that we have. I would like to thank all of the panellists. They've been great. It's been a very stimulating debate, and it's good to come towards the end with them openly disagreeing. I would also like to thank Jackie Gauntlett. She's the BJS manager. She has done a fantastic job in getting this event off the ground. So thank you to the panellists and to Jackie, and will you please join us upstairs for a drink, where you can, in the immediate future at least, continue the debate, and we hope for many years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.